Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the May 27th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Another Memorial Day has come and gone, and with it the familiar speeches from the president and other public officials intended to convince us that amidst the picnics and the barbecues and the annual visits to our country's military cemeteries, that they generally care about the servicemen and women interred beneath those cemetery grounds. What will not have been heard or mentioned, in keeping with the past 46 Memorial Days and counting, are the names of 34 crewmen from the USS Liberty who on June 8, 1967 were murdered and the 174 who were wounded in broad daylight by the Israeli Air Force and Navy in the waters off the coast of Israel in the midst of the Six-Day War. It was the third day of that war, launched to establish Israel's dominance over the Middle East and extend its borders north, south, and west. And apparently the Israeli military did not want the crew of the Liberty, easily identifiable as a U.S. Navy intelligence ship, gathering ship, to overhear its plans to invade Syria and capture the Golan Heights. So America's staunch Middle East ally tried its very best to sink it. And while physically it failed to do so, Israel and its powerful domestic lobby have largely succeeded in erasing the crime from America's memory banks, including our children's history books. On the rare occasions when the incident has been raised, Israel's claim that the attack was a case of mistaken identity, that its pilots had not seen the Liberty's huge American flag flying in the breeze and confused it with a much smaller Egyptian ship, is accepted without question. The betrayal of crew of the U.S. Liberty began at the highest level of the U.S. government when President Lyndon Johnson ordered U.S. fighter jets from the nearest aircraft carrier, the USS Saratoga, on their way to defend the Liberty to turn back with the identity of the attackers because, as he told the disbelieving Admiral Franklin Geis in command of the Saratoga, "We will not embarrass an ally." Every one of Johnson's successors and all the flag-waving patriots in Congress since, not the least of them Senator John McCain, whose admiral father oversaw the Navy's cover-up of the attack, have refused to initiate a congressional investigation of the incident, despite demands from the survivors of the Liberty to do so. That is something to think about as a Republican-led Congress renews its feeding frenzy over the murder of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, in Benghazi, which pales both in scale and significance when compared to Israel's attack on the Liberty. That attack, which will be the subject of today's program, might accurately be called the defining event in the history of U.S.-Israel relations, since it demonstrated to the Israelis and their supporters in this country that they could kill Americans in cold blood and get away with it. My guest to speak about the attack on the Liberty will be Allison Weir, investigative journalist and author of Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, and founder of If Americans Knew, who has devoted a considerable amount of her time to bringing the story of the Liberty and its significance to the American public. We'll be speaking with Allison in New York at about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. There is a gesture among dogs, thought to signify submission, when they roll over on their backs before a more powerful opponent. Whatever truth there is to that interpretation, it characterizes the strange relationship between a superpower of the United States and a country whose total population is less than a quarter of that of California, namely Israel. Israeli journalist Uri Misgav wrote about the latest example of American servitude to Israel in last Friday's Haaretz, a new $1.9 billion arms giveaway, depending on who you're reading in the Israeli press, from President Obama's White House that, not surprisingly, the U.S. media has yet to report on. It warms the heart to hear the Pentagon's compensation deal with Israel in exchange for the agreement with Iran, is how Misgav began his article. The deal, according to the article and confirmed from other sources, consists of 8,000 smart bombs, 14,500 smart bomb guidance systems, 50 bunker busters, 4,100 small bombs, only 110 kilograms of explosives, and 3,000 Hellfire missiles for the Apache helicopters, but does not include separate agreements by Washington to provide another 3,000 bomb guidance kits and enlarge Israel's F-35 stealth bomber fleet scheduled for its first delivery next year. Those will cost U.S. taxpayers $110 million a pop, and Israel, already in line for 35 of them, wants an additional 15, all paid for, of course, by you, the American taxpayers. What is all this armament intended for and where, asked Miskov. To ensure an Israeli attack in Iran immediately after the powers sign an international agreement with it? Perhaps just to replenish stockpiles after the last war rampage in Gaza, which broke all the Israel Defense Forces records in ammunition use, he wonders. Well, the Pentagon one announced that these deals reflect, quote, the American commitment to Israel's security, he noted, but, quote, history has proved that reckless armament doesn't lead to security, it leads mainly to wars. Since 2006, Uri Miskov pointed out, when Israel began to base its warfare almost exclusively on air power and pounding from the air, we've had one war in Lebanon and three in Gaza, four wars in less than a decade. End quote. And I must repeat, they did all this with weapons paid for by the earnings of American taxpayers, who, thanks to a media as subservient to Israel as is our government, have little to no idea of their culpability. Another Haaretz correspondent, or journalist, Uday Basharat, has an explanation. Quote, it seems Obama has decided that the best way to deal with the harsh things he hears coming out of Israel is hypocrisy. With one hand, he condemns Israel, and with the other, he signs a deal of supply with arms. You've learned a pretty good lesson from the Zionists, Mr. President, he wrote. The world remembers your obsession against the phrase, Arabs heading to the polls in droves, the warning to Israel's Jewish voters that was uttered by Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu and criticized by Obama. But no one will notice the aircraft you're supplying as punishment for the Prime Minister's racist comments. With punishments like that, he adds, I feel like sinning, end quote. But that wasn't all that our president provided his Israeli counterpart. On Friday night, according to Haaretz's Barik Ravid and the Reuters News Service, the U.S. blocked the issuing of a concluding statement for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference that closed in New York following objections voiced by Israel. The final draft of the concluding statement was expected to call on U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to convene an international conference on making the Middle East a nuclear weapons-free zone by March 2016. Israel, the only country in that region with nuclear weapons, objected to the deadline. After 4 weeks of negotiations at the U.N., there was no consensus among its 191 signatories. U.S. Undersecretary of State Rose Guatemala accused Egypt and other Arab states of bringing, quote, unrealistic and unworkable conditions to the negotiations. The U.S. concerns were echoed by Canada and Britain, both of which, like Washington, are in Israel's pocket. In view of the close ties that currently exist between Israel and the leading Arab states, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia, I am inclined to suspect that the whole conference was a sham designed not to produce a nuclear-free Middle East, but to restore the illusion among peoples of the region that the Arab states are not in bed with both Washington and Tel Aviv. The last scheduled conference was to have been held in November 2012. It was canceled by Obama before it ever started, again out of concern for Israel. A Reuters article at the time suggested that Washington acted out of its concern that the conference could be used by Middle East countries to, quote, bash Israel, noting that Israel and the United States do not publicly acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons. By way of explanation, the State Department said, quote, we would not support a conference in which any regional state would be subject to pressure or isolation, end quote, except Iran. 3 years later, despite recently declassified government documents, ignored, of course, by the national media, indicating the Defense Department knew that Israel not only had nuclear weapons, but was working on a hydrogen bomb, Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry still choose to roll over on their backs. Their behavior and Obama's appeal to Jewish leaders for their support last week at a prominent Washington synagogue throws into serious question whether he will stand by an agreement limiting Iran's nuclear energy program between the P5 nations plus Germany and Iran if it's signed, if Congress votes to reject it. After threatening to veto any legislation passed by Congress that would impede the success of the agreement, Obama backed down and signed legislation passed by both House and Senate, giving them 30 days to review the agreement before taking an up or down vote whether to approve it. On one important other front, those alleging that the self-styled Islamic State is a creation of the U.S., Israel, and their Arab and Muslim allies, it received a boost from the release of Defense Intelligence Agency documents that suggest it is exactly that. On Monday, May 18th, the right-wing government watchdog group Judicial Watch published a selection of formally classified documents obtained from the Defense and State Departments through a federal lawsuit designed to ferret out information on the attack on the American Embassy consulate in Benghazi. While the mainstream media was focusing on the White House's handling of the Benghazi attack, one of the DIA documents, circulated in 2012, postulated that, quote, an Islamic State was desirable in eastern Syria to challenge the government headed by Bashar Assad. The precise wording leaves no doubt about it. Quote, the West, Gulf countries, and Turkey, who support the Syrian opposition, the document reads, there is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria, and this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, end quote. The DIA report, formerly classified secret, no foreign, which means not to be circulated to foreign countries, was dated August 12, 2012, and circulated widely among various government agencies, among them CENTCOM, the CIA, FBI, Department of Homeland Security, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or NGA, and the State Department. The document indicates that as early as 3 years ago, U.S. intelligence anticipated the rise of ISIS, but instead of viewing it as an enemy or a threat, the report envisions the group as a U.S. strategic asset in overthrowing the Assad government. While the role of Western intelligence agencies in the formation and training of the armed opposition in Syria has been well documented, this is the strongest confirmation of the theory to date. Despite ISIS's gory record of beheadings and massacres, it appears that Western governments, including our own, plus Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the Sunni-dominated Gulf states, see it not as it's viewed through the eyes of the Western public, but as a tool for regime change in Syria and an ally in the crusade against Iran and its Shia allies. That extends to the U.S. Congress, whatever words of criticism its Republican leadership may utter about Obama's handling of the problem. One recent proof of that, which you probably haven't heard about, for the usual reasons, was a 423-0 vote in the House on May 14th. 423-0, with 9 not voting, on what's called the Hezbollah International Financing Prevention Act of 2015. It's designed to cut off any access to outside funding to the one organization that is leading the fight on the ground against the Islamic State in Syria. The legislation, which now goes to the Senate, makes it U.S. policy, quote, to prevent Hezbollah's global logistics and financial network from operating in order to curtail funding of its domestic and international activities and utilize all available diplomatic, legislative, and executive avenues to combat the global criminal activities of Hezbollah as a means to block that organization's ability to fund its global terrorist activities, end quote. No evidence is furnished for its alleged global terrorist activities. As with the sanctions against Iran, the intention of the legislation is to force foreign governments and financial institutions that recognize Hezbollah as a legitimate part of Lebanon's political life to acquiesce to American law and punish those who do not abide by it, as well as media providers that carry Hezbollah's TV channel Al-Manar, on which I was interviewed when I was last in Lebanon 8 years ago. By no coincidence, the day before the bill was to be voted on, a major article in Hezbollah appeared in the New York Times international section with a headline spread across 6 columns declaring, quote, Israel says Hezbollah military sites put Lebanese civilians at a risk, end quote. It was less a news article than a rewritten press release issued by the Israeli military. the point which was to let the world know, quote, that in the event of another conflict with Hezbollah, many Lebanese civilians will probably be killed and that it should not be considered Israel's fault, end quote. But why would Hezbollah consider initiating a war given its heavy involvement in Syria? The answer is it wouldn't. The war will be started by Israel, as the very last paragraph tells us, as of all Israel's previous conflicts in Lebanon, 1978, 1982, and 2006. Quote, an Israeli expert familiar with military planning said that if Israel attacked Lebanon again, it would probably do so in three phases. First, it would strike without warning at targets that pose the greatest threat, he said. Then it would call for civilians to evacuate southern Lebanon. That's a routine Israeli exercise. Quote, once a critical mass of people had left, ground forces would move in, end quote. Four wars in 10 years and Israel still not satiated. Significance of the story and where it appeared was not lost on Haaretz, which is sometimes referred to as the New York Times of Israel, but not when it comes to covering the Israel-Arab conflict. Interpreting the article as I did, Haaretz's report on the subject was appropriately headlined, quote, Israel's secret weapon in the war against Hezbollah, the New York Times, end quote. The U.S. media demonizing of Hezbollah has a long and ugly history, and like Congress, it dances to Tel Aviv's tune. Otherwise, it would have reported that Hezbollah has been in an alliance with the largest Christian party in Lebanon, the Free Patriotic Movement, or FPM, plus several smaller Christian parties, among a number of others, since 2006. During a trip to Lebanon in 2007, I had an opportunity to speak at length with a leader of the FPM, former President and General Michel Aoun. Aoun told me quite candidly that were it not for the presence of Hezbollah, Israel would overrun his country. Hezbollah, it should be remembered, arose in resistance to Israel's occupation of Lebanon following its invasion of that country in June 1982. By another coincidence, yesterday, March 26th, was the 15th anniversary of Israel's humiliating withdrawal from that country. After 18 years of occupation, when the mounting casualties became more than the Israeli public was willing to accept. Finally, you've heard a lot about the Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, but not many details about the gigantic giveaway to the multinational corporations that Obama is trying to sell us as a beneficial trade agreement while keeping the fine print secret. There is one part of that it is known but hasn't been reported, and you may have guessed it involves Israel, the first love of many of our senators and House members. In this case, it's Maryland's Ben Cardin, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who is also one of 25 members of Congress on the advisory board of the Israel Project, a tax-exempt pro-Israel operation that lobbies the media on Israel's behalf. Also on that advisory board is Oregon's Ron Wyden, the key Democrat pushing the TPA. On March 2nd, the Senate Finance Committee voted unanimously to insert an amendment into the legislation, and Cardin was its principal sponsor. According to Cardin, who's also the ranking Democrat on the Finance Committee, the amendment would, quote, include among the principal negotiating objectives of the United States regarding commercial partnerships, discouraging activity that penalizes or otherwise limits commercial relations with Israel. The intended targets of this are the European Union countries that want Israel to identify products they export that originate in Jewish-only settlements and occupied Palestinian lands, and also to prevent any measure being taken that would result in a boycott of Israeli goods. The least we can do is demand the Israeli government pay their salaries, because that's who these senators are really working for, not us.